Welcome to the Bova UK podcast, where we will be discussing diseases from diagnosis through to management. These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon. Hello, everybody. And today I have got Dr. Nicola Menzies-Gow with me. Nicola is a lecturer in equine medicine at the Royal Veterinary College, and she's also an RCVS and European internal specialist with a special interest in endocrine disease. So welcome, Nicola. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Although, as we were just saying, a little bit windy. So if my roof blows off, then we might have to have a momentary pause.
Fortunately, we're okay in Hertfordshire. It's not been too windy. So far, so good down here.
You're sat in your cozy office.
Well, all right.
So you've got a special interest in endocrine. And can you maybe tell me a bit more about your interests?
So my interest sort of started when I did my residency project, because when I joined the RVC as an equine medicine resident, I got given my project, and that was looking into endotoxemia and colic and laminitis that occurred in the post-op colic patient. And I was looking at blood flow to the feet to see if that would explain why some did or didn't get laminitis. And then that residency project got extended into a PhD. So I continued with that and looking at, again, more studies into endotoxemia, did some endotoxin infusions, looking at inflammatory mediators. And then having done the PhD, I then moved into the more focusing on the laminitis and less on the endotoxemia side of the research. And then it's kind of really morphed from there. So initially it was just laminitis, and now it's extended from laminitis into endocrinopathic laminitis and endocrine disease, and looking at equine metabolic syndrome and pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction. So over the course of about the last 20 odd years of all the research, it's had a sort of a gradual progression from endotoxemia to laminitis to endocrine disease. It's kind of how it's gone.
Oh, obviously quite helpful today. We are talking a bit about PPID and compliance. So really, what should we be aiming for when treating horses for PPID?
Well, if we're thinking from the compliance point of view, we'd like our owners to be giving them the treatment that we're recommending. So we duly, as vets, say, please, can you give it, for example, one tablet once a day for the next month, 2 months or whatever, and then I'll come back and we'll redo the bloods and we'll see how the pony's doing. And then you duly go away and you don't think about it again, and you assume that the owner is then doing what you asked them to do. But in reality, that isn't actually what happens. We all know it's the same with us when we do or don't take the prescriptions that we're given. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we remember and sometimes we forget. Sometimes we think, oh, I forgot one, I'll just take another one now, that will do the job. And the veterinary owners are no different. They do the same. Sometimes they forget. Sometimes they decide, for whatever reason, that they're going to do something different to that which we recommend. And I think we as vets, we don't consider that aspect of it. We assume the owner will do what they're told, and we just, when the horse isn't getting better, we assume, for example, we must increase the dose or change the mm-hmm. drug or whatever. We don't necessarily think that maybe the owner hasn't done what we asked them to do, and we need to investigate that before we move on to something else.
I think I'm probably one of those naughty people who always forgets to dose myself, so I'm terrible when it comes to the animals. Is pergolide always necessary with these PPID cases?
I don't think so. It depends. It depends on the individual animal and it depends on the owner. So you need to have a conversation with them. I think mostly mm-hmm. is governed by the clinical signs that the PPID animal has. We all know that laminitis is the one that seems to have the biggest impact on their quality of life because it's painful. And it seems to be the reason for euthanasia in most cases. Because, for example, they can quite happily be a bit hairy and a bit sweaty and you clip them to try and control that, etc. But you need to find out what the owner wants, because obviously it is a lifelong condition. We're mm-hmm. managing it, we're not curing it. There's going to be a gradual decline, because even if you treat them with a pergolide, there will be a gradual progression of the disease. So at some point, the animal will get to the point where they don't respond to the therapy, or something else will cause you to euthanize them first. So you need to discuss it with the owner as to what they want and whether they're willing to embark on lifelong therapy, whether they can give the animal treatment every day, whether they can afford it in the first place, whether they can afford to have the response to treatment monitored with blood samples. You've got to look at the individual animal in the individual circumstance and try and work out what's best for that animal and that owner, because then you're going to end up with the best result. There's no point forcing an owner to do something that they just can't possibly do.
No, sure. You mentioned there about the testing, and the ACTH would be the main test, wouldn't it? And
yes.
How is that? Is it useful compared to looking at just the clinical signs?
That's the big debate. There's been lots of studies looking at this, and then there have been what you call meta-analysis or reviews of all the published studies to see how good measuring basal ACTH concentrations are. I think it's better now we know we need seasonally adjusted reference ranges, but mm-hmm. we have to remember that it's not a perfect test. I think the figures come out somewhere in the region of about 80% odd for the sensitivity and specificity in these reviews of the study. So 4 out of 5 times, it's giving you the right answer, both in the positive and the negative direction. But 1 in 5 times, it's not getting you the right answer. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that we need to bear in mind when the test doesn't give us the answer that we're expecting when we look at the horse. So I know some people are very intent on that you have to make sure that you do the blood test and that you have to almost chase a number to make sure that the animal is responding. But I'm a big advocate of looking at the horse and looking at its clinical signs and putting that together with the blood test, because if your blood test is normal but your horse isn't getting better, then you want to know why. And that's more important, is if the horse has still got repeated bouts of laminitis or its hair coat looks no better, etc., then I would want to know why and want to sort of go looking at why that might be, rather than worrying that your number hasn't quite come back to within the reference range.
So ACTH, it doesn't necessarily have to return to normal, or does it?
It doesn't in all animals. I think that in an ideal world it would do. But there are certainly a significant number of horses out there that seem to be that however high you go with your pergolide dose, that they just don't come back down to within the reference range. The clinical signs, again, you get two different categories of animal. Some of them, their ACTH comes down a bit, their clinical signs improve, and the owner reports the animal's doing really well. And I think that's probably a good enough outcome, personally. Other people might disagree. You'll get others where it doesn't come down and the animal doesn't improve, and then that's more important. That both haven't improved, to be honest.
Follow up, definitely. Yeah. If the horse is happier in itself, surely you are winning. So
I think so. And I think as long as you're confident that what the owner is telling you is true, that its lethargy, for example, is improved, that its hair coat is improved, because they're better at judging these things. They spend a lot more time with the animals than we do, rather than we waltz in, look at the animal and waltz out again and just get a snapshot,
a
don't
glimpse.
We? So, yeah, again, you have to bear in mind that the owner may well have a little bit of a biased outlook. They want the animal to be getting better. So sometimes you can do things objectively. Well, how many times has it had laminitis in the last year? And if the answer to that is 6 times, well, I think clearly you're not winning. So again, you have to put all of these things together and not just look at the ACTH value, put it together with the horse itself and with what the owner thinks that the horse is doing.
What about insulin concentrations? More and more people seem to be looking at that. Is it worthwhile, do you think?
I think that's very important, because we now understand that insulin dysregulation occurs in a subset of animals with PPRD mm-hmm. because their mm-hmm. pituitary-derived hormones, we think, somehow causes the insulin dysregulation. Exactly how that occurs is still to be decided. But certainly those with insulin dysregulation seem to be the ones that get the laminitis, and they seem to be the ones with the poorer prognosis. So I think that's important. One, mm-hmm. because you can then tell the owner that, so they have realistic expectations. And then two, that's another thing that you can sort of look towards improving. It may well improve with just the pergolide. If you control the PPRD, then you would hope that the insulin dysregulation would improve. But it may be something that you also need to then look at the animal's diet and or exercise, depending on how it's sore its feet are, to see whether you can do other things as well as just the specific PPRD treatment to try and improve the insulin dysregulation.
You mentioned pergolide and insulin dysregulation. Does the pergolide bring the insulin concentration down?
It doesn't specifically, but you would. The theory is that it's the PPRD that's driving the insulin dysregulation. So if you improve the PPRD with the pergolide, then the mm-hmm. insulin should come down. It's not a direct effect of pergolide on insulin. It's like an indirect okay. effect.
Do you think PPRD is really that relevant to the development of laminitis, or are we dismissing EMS cases?
That's a big question, is an answer. So It seems to be the insulin that's driving the laminitis in the PPID cases, is what we do know, simply by measuring insulin sensitivity in these animals. So we can say that for sure. And we presume that because they have PPID and insulin dysregulation, we presume that the PPID occurred first, and that's what's driving the insulin dysregulation. But, and we've speculated as to which hormones it might be. We've blamed CLIP, we've blamed betatropin, we've blamed cortisol historically, but we don't know, is the honest answer. We don't know for sure. So we are presuming that. But equally, there are some animals that start off with EMS, so equine metabolic syndrome, earlier in their life. And then because PPID is an age-related disease, then they develop PPID later in their lifetime. So they started off with EMS, and then they have EMS plus PPID. So their insulin dysregulation started off not due to PPID. So then you presume that the laminitis was initially being driven by the insulin dysregulation because of the equine metabolic syndrome, but now maybe it's been driven by a combination of both, if that makes sense.
It's very confusing, isn't it?
It is confusing. That's the trouble. And I do have this trouble when we lecture the students. They get very confused because it's not black and white, because we don't have the answers. Laminitis and endocrine disorder and endocrinopathic laminitis, whatever heading you want to have, we know bits, we know pieces of the puzzle, but we don't know everything yet. We speculate the bits in between and we extrapolate from what happens in people with metabolic syndrome and what's been shown in lab animals, those kind of studies, but we don't know for sure. Is what makes it difficult.
So each horse is going to throw up a new curveball for you as well.
It does do. And every time we find out a new bit of information, then we go, well, okay, well, now we know that, but what about this, this, and this? And we still don't know that, that, and that. So I once went to a conference, I'm showing my age now, back in, I think it was about 2000. And the strapline for the conference was solving laminitis by 2020. Well, here we are in 2022 and we've not yet solved laminitis. So yeah, I have failed dismally on that.
I think there's definitely been a lot more development over the years. So I think you're winning.
We're getting closer, but as I say, we don't have all the answers. So if it doesn't make sense, it's because it doesn't make sense, because we don't know. Yet.
Yeah. A lot of horses, they only seem to respond partially to perglide. Is there a reason why?
We don't know. Again, if you've got one that falls into that category, the first thing you would check, well, is the perglide going into the pony? Because if the pony's not getting the drug, then there's no way it's going to get better. So that would be the first thing I would check. And then it's not a cut and dry. It's not a yes, this drug will either make you better or it won't. And that's the same with lots of other things. We have various diseases in veterinary medicine, for example, that do either completely or partially respond to corticosteroid therapy. You think of things like inflammatory bowel disease, that they help to a certain extent because we're just managing the disease. We're not curing it. So it's not surprising that not all of them respond the same and not all of them respond completely.
Why do Shetlands and older horses seem to have such poor levels of compliance?
Well, you can imagine for the Shetland, can't you? If you've spent any time with a little Shetland, you can possibly can imagine why the owner has difficulty getting it in. One, I think it's probably
getting down to their level, right?
Getting down. Well, yeah, it is really. It's the practical things like that you've got to think of. You've got to try and get the drug into the pony. And sometimes they're clever little devils and they will do anything to avoid it. Not just the Shetlands, obviously. I'm sure there are other breeds you can think of. On the whole, certainly when we have them in the referral hospital to have to do the things with, they can be difficult. And they have very good tricks at not doing what you want them to do. So you can imagine why. And also, I think maybe part of the problem is, joking aside, is that they're more difficult to dose because they need parts of a tablet rather than a whole tablet. So then you're reliant on dividing it up into the right sized chunk, really. And if you think, if you've got, it's the same for us, isn't it? As soon as you start trying to split tablets, you never get even halves or even quarters. So the smaller the bit that you need for the animal, the less likely you are to get the right size dose into that animal's. So that's the Shetland thing. And then the older animals, well, again, there's evidence that as animals get older, people, not everybody, but people tend to, they turn them out, they retire them, they do less with them, they get less attention. So maybe the owners are less attentive and on giving them the dose, remembering to give them the dose, that kind of thing. And maybe they're less keen on spending the money as well. Because if we're talking a couple of pounds every day on a horse that's retired and just sits in a field, then that might be a financial commitment that owners don't want to make.
A lot of investment with time as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
There have been some studies recently on perglide paste at the University of Queensland showing equivocal clinical and endocrinological responses to the registered tablet. Do you think compliance can be improved with preparations that are easier to give?
I think so, because if the owner thinks it's easier to give, then you're more likely to get it into the animal. You would hope that sort of if you give them something, for example, you give them the paste rather than tablet and go, this has been shown that horses like the taste, it's easier to give to them, then they will at least be motivated at the start. And then if it is truly easier to give and then they find it out, then they'll be more keen to continue. I guess you're going to get the odd horse that's going to be resistant to that. We all know horses that you can't worm. And as soon as you go near them with a wormer, they go straight up in the air and they're off quicker than that. But the majority of the horses are used to having things syringed into their mouth, aren't they? They're used to having wormers, they're used to having the bit in their mouth, all those kind of things. So you would hope that most horses are easier to give it that way. And then you're not reliant so much on sort of hiding it in a bit of food so that and them not eating around it and that kind of thing. So I can imagine that a paste would help.
And surely with the titration?
If it's like a wormer and you're dosing it for weight and you've got reasonable weight boundaries on the syringe, again, that's going to be easier. If you can do it to per 50 kilos or whatever, then you're more likely to get something that's closer. Yeah, I would agree.
Definitely. The other thing is we've heard in the US and Australia more and more vets using cabergolin injection rather than daily perglide. Is it because it's more effective or is it just to overcome compliance issues, do you think?
I haven't got any personal experience with cabergoline. So if it's been shown to be as effective, i.e. the reports are that a similar percentage of animals improve in their clinical signs or a similar percentage of animals, their ACTH normalise, whatever you like to monitor, then I can imagine that a once a week injection that again, the owners will find preferable. Mm-hmm. I guess the main limiting thing might be the cost, because it would depend on whether the owner's allowed to administer it or they've got to pay for a vet to come once a week to administer it. If you're on a yard that's big enough and you have sort of routine visits, then that's not so bad. But if you're having to pay full whack for a visit each time, then that might be the limiting factor. And also if you've got an animal that's needle shy, then that might be a limiting factor. But I can see if they've just got to remember Monday morning, the vet comes and gives the injection, then that's much easier than if you've got to remember 7 days a week to give it. So, and again, dose titration, you would hope that you could get a more accurate dose by however many mils that you give the animal compared to literally you've just got a 1 milligram tablet that you have to give either a whole one or a half one and not much in between. So I can see the advantages.
There's hope for the Shetlands, yeah.
There is hope for the Shetlands, as long as their owners are happy to spend the money on them.
Oh, come on, they're great for children.
They are.
Most of the time.
Yeah, if they're in the right mood, then they're good for children.
Sending the children off into the distance.
Yeah.
So do you think the cabergolin, the once-weekly cabergolin injection, would be helpful in the management of PPID cases?
I guess we need the evidence, don't we? We need some scientific evidence, first of all, to show what concentrations you get in the horse, in its blood. Because again, I think we as vets sometimes just give the horse a drug based on what the human dose is and expect it to do the same thing. We found that with metformin. We duly gave lots of ponies metformin and found that only 7% was absorbed and 93% ended up on the floor. So we have the advantage with an injection that you know it actually goes in the animal because you're injecting it in. But what we need to know is, does it last? Do you get therapeutic concentrations for that whole week? Or is it only sufficient for the first couple of days and then it wanes after that? So then it drops below therapeutic concentrations. So if we had evidence to show that you get equal reduction in the pituitary output of its hormones, then you would imagine that it would be just as effective as the pergolide. But we'd need to see that evidence, which hopefully will come soon.
Hopefully, one day.
Hopefully. That and also you're based on, so if it, obviously we're a little bit more limited in the UK, aren't we? Because you have to use the licensed product for the disease that it is. So and unless you then show that the pergolide isn't working, and then you can move on to other things. And the trouble is, if you move on to other things in animals that pergolide isn't working, maybe there's a reason why dopamine agonists aren't working, and the
In general.
cabergoline may equally not have a chance of working. So then you get the false impression that oh, it doesn't work, it's no good. So we need to see the cabergoline used under the conditions that you would normally use the pergolide, so you can directly compare how well it seems to work.
Suppose in those situations where neither are working, then you're back to the drawing board anyway,
Yeah,
aren't you?
you are. And then we start scratching around and adding in the cyproheptadine and all the rest of it. So I think some drugs get a bad name because they're only ever used as a last resort. And they're always going to not do so well because you're using in the animals that are already not responding. So a once-a-week injection certainly has potential, as long as we know that it, as I say, it lasts that long, and it seems to have an equal effect on the pituitary.
Brilliant. Just starting to think about rounding up the conversation. I think we've ticked off most of my questions already. Any take-home messages?
I guess the take-home message would be, if the pony's not getting better, then look to see whether it's actually receiving the drug or not, rather than just instantly assuming you have to give it more pergolide. I would have a conversation with the owner, not being accusatory. Just say, look, I'm just wondering if you're having any difficulty getting the pergolide into the pony, and start the conversation that way, because then you might be able to talk to them about different ways of getting it in. You can look on all these horsey forums, and people have a million and one suggestions of how to get it in. You mix it with apple paste, with custard, with all kinds of, you hide it in a carrot, you hide it in a polo, all of the kind of things that some people find work and some people don't. But at least it's the way of opening the conversation with the owner to find out whether compliance is a real issue or not before you start upping the dose or looking to a different drug, both of which might also have sort of financial implications for the owner. Because if you're doubling the dose, you're going to double the price that they're spending every day, and then you may end up with even more issues if the owner doesn't tell you that they can't afford that.
Well, Nicola, that's been very insightful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
These podcasts are aimed for registered vets and veterinary nurses. If you're listening as a pet owner, then we always advise that if you have any concerns about your animal, then please consult with your local veterinary surgeon.